from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, San Francisco's Omega Boys Club is marking 25 years, helping at-risk kids lead lives free from violence and incarceration, also helping them to succeed academically and make positive contributions to society. Omega has provided academic and life skills support to more than 1,300 boys and girls, and its violence prevention programs have reached more than 15,000 students. Co-founder and executive director Joe Marshall joins us as part of our first-person series on the leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area unique. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. And in this Forum hour, we continue our first-person series with Dr. Joe Marshall, a MacArthur Genius Award recipient and also a recipient of the Congressional Freedom Works Award, who for the past quarter of a century has been working with inner-city at-risk youth. In 1987, along with Jack Jacqua, he founded the Omega Boys Club, which, with the Training Institute and Leadership Academy, has transformed the lives of thousands of young people. A former member of the San Francisco Police Commission, founder of the Alive and Free Movement, and author of Street Soldier, and also host of Street Soldier on the radio, Joe Marshall joins us in studio for the second Forum Hour. And so good to have you back on Forum. I was thinking before you came on the air, we go back actually to the founding of the Omega Boys Club, and we both had a lot more hair then.
We do go back a ways, and thanks for having me again. I got to correct one thing.
Please.
I'm still on the San Francisco Police Commission. I was a former president, but I'm the vice president.
I didn't mean to take you off, Joe.
I think that Mayor Lee would say, what happened to Dr. Marshall?
So yeah, especially you were right. With Mayor Lee just last night on a rival radio station, still doing that radio program, Street Soldier. Let's talk about your work, because it's been so important, and it's been such a centerpiece, not only here, but nationally and even internationally. And a lot of it has to do with life skills, and a lot of it has to do with education. And I want to talk with you about both those. But my memory goes back to something you've been pretty consistent with all the years, and that is violence as a public health issue.
Exactly. That's sort of been, I guess, where I sort of separated myself from other youth programming. Violence as a public health issue, even going so far as to calling violence a disease. That's exactly what I call it. It acts like a disease. It works like a disease. So we treat it like a disease. And I always say to young people I work with, much like a computer is fine, the worst thing you can get is a virus. So my young people get infected with their way of thinking, believing that it helped them to survive. It actually helps them die and go to prison. So it's a way for me to get inside the minds of to help young people. Everybody understands people getting sick, and if you get sick, you can get well. Heretofore, young people who get into violence have been labeled as bad, and because they believe they're bad, and they go to jail where there are other, quote, infected people, they never really get treated for what ails them. So that's why recidivism is actually so high. It's people. I always say people don't change when they go to jail. They just do time.
And aren't there a few of them that, I mean, maybe small number who really are bad, though? I mean, you meet some
I just don't use that word because I think it is sad. I think they behave badly, but I don't know if they're necessarily bad people. I mean, I've never encountered a really bad kid. I've encountered young people who are into things they shouldn't be doing. But a lot of them get into them because actually they've been told that this way of acting is actually going to work for them. I mean, if you ask any person who's out there doing something like that, they'll say they're just trying to survive. They believe they've acquired some survival skill.
There are pathologies, though. I mean, you see some kids torturing animals at a young age, doing all those kinds of things. It may be disease-like, but it takes a course and a trajectory that often just seems to almost be there for some reason.
Oh, I'm sure there are pathologies. Most of the kids I work with are into violent behavior because they think getting into this, selling drugs, carrying a gun, getting into gangs are a way to protect themselves or a way to survive. And it's the disease is inappropriately named. It's not a survival skill. It is a death or incarceration skill. And they believe that, you know, that there's no way out.
And then also I can feel bigger and I can feel prouder and I can feel more connected to well, gang or whatever it is, because I have weapons and I'm violent, I'm big and bad, that kind of stuff.
Well, they're trying to get respect. They're trying to be somebody. They're looking for protection. And they really think that if they do these things, they're going to get there. That's here I come along and say, so, well, you've been to jail 18 times. Obviously, you're not getting there. So they've been sold a bill of goods.
Well, you are a salesman in some ways, too. You sell them on the idea of education, on the idea of having something other than the gang to go to or the street to go to.
You know, I believe in them. I know what they really are inside, and maybe this happened because I was a teacher early on, and I saw things that necessarily other folks didn't see. You know, when you're a teacher, you see the other side of them. Sometimes you actually know the real name. Well, you do know the real name because you got the role in front of you. So I kind of know what's there. I always say I have to see it for them when they can't see it themselves, and I say, you know, I know this isn't really you. And there's a pushback because they've been pushed back a lot, you know, from the people in their neighborhood and oftentimes in their homes.
And the homes play a very central role in this, in the sense that in so many cases we're talking about Joe Marshall as a father figure because there is no father.
If I put this in a very simplistic terms, what I have been for the past 25 years is everybody's dad. I will tell you that's true. I know how to be a father and I know how to be a teacher. And you're right. My kids really lack that. Even when I was doing my PhD is in psychology and I did family therapy. But it's hard for me to repair that unit. But I found it actually easy to replace than repair. And what's missing with most of the kids I work with is a dad, absolutely.
Which is why gangs are, I mean, they provide a kind of surrogate family, don't they, in many instances?
Well, they provide the wrong kind of family.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the kids think that is family because they don't really know what a functional family is. And so, you know, a real family doesn't threaten you or to hurt you when you want to leave and do your own thing. So, I think what we do, Omega is not really a program. I say it's really a family.
Talking to Joseph Marshall, who is executive director and co-founder of Omega Boys Club, street soldiers and vice president of the San Francisco Police Commission, as he noted. And I mean, it's an amazing record. 176 have graduated college, have come through under your tutelage and under your mentorship, 40 grad school graduates and counting. And now, having these veteran 25 years behind you, you're probably, is it safe to say, I don't want to make you sound, you know, heaven for fen conceited about this, but you're better at it than you were when you started.
I'm a lot better at it. What I really did, now let me tell you what I learned. I learned that opportunity and good intention is not enough. A lot of times people ask me, what makes your program different? Most programs, and I operated under this when I was beginning, use the opportunity and good intention model. They want to give kids an opportunity because that's what kids ask for. And young people, I want a job. I want a chance. I'm really going to do well. My opportunity was education. I didn't commit to jobs because, as you can see, I can't control the economy. But I knew I could deliver on education.
You sound like President Obama.
I knew I wanted something I could deliver on, and education was something I could make happen. And I would give young people the opportunity. Early on, I found out I had this young man, and he was a gang member in San Francisco. He wanted to get out. He wanted to turn his life around. I asked him what he wanted to do. He said he always wanted to go to school. He'd been told that he couldn't do it. He'd been discouraged, but he wanted to do it. I said, well, you know, college is a big deal. I got to prepare you. You got to be ready. I prepared him academically, a very smart young man. I put him on a plane. I gave him a check, and he sold drugs on the college campus. And what I realized then
it
was
broke your heart too. Didn't
well, it did. But I'd given him what he wanted. He wanted an opportunity. He had the good, very good intentions to succeed. But I'll put it this way: in my terms, the way I would say it is, I had taken the boy out of the hood, but I hadn't taken the
hood out of the boy.
That's right. And so what we specialize in, really, is doing that, getting rid of those things that short-circuit opportunity and good intention. How many times do we give young people a job and you know, they can't make it because they're not prepared and there are things in them. They still see, what this young man, he thought the same way as he did when he was here in San Francisco. I have to change the way young people think. And so that they can make good on their opportunity. And since then, our graduation rate has been something like 94%, which is about 40% at this point, is higher than the national average.
That's amazing. Congratulations. What's changed the most over these 25 years? You're almost talking about learning how to rewire in some respects. I don't
absolutely
want to make it
reprogram.
Mechanical
sounding. Yeah, reprogram. Absolutely. Is, yeah. Yeah. You know, what's changed? Probably in all the years I started in 1987, one of the communities I work with, the big change actually came before that. The big change really became when crack cocaine came into the neighborhoods, and that greatly affected the families. It basically just destroyed neighborhoods and destroyed communities. So I often talk to the kids about BC and AC before crack and after crack and how different things were. The kids don't believe that I ever went to a funeral of one of my friends. They don't. They've gone to 16, 17, 18 funerals by the time they've turned 18. The kids wear T-shirts with people's, you know, with pictures of their deceased friends on there. I had never had a T-shirt like that. You know, so things are very different. The issue for me growing up, and I grew up in a tough neighborhood, you know, South Central Los Angeles. The issue was whether or not I wanted to fight. The issue for them is whether they live or die. So, you know, things are very different. I had a talk with them about the other day, what they would like to see come back. They were very, was very, very interesting what they would like to see. And one of the things they said, they'd like kids to be kids again, kids to be kids. These kids grow up so fast. They're the boy of the house. They're the man of the house. They're the woman of the house at the age of 12 or 13. So families have really, really have been the central thing. I often say that I'm in business because families are in disarray. And one, maybe my, the thing I feel most about it for all these years is not the college graduations, not being able to go around the world and help people stay alive and free, I like to put it, but being able to actually create families, seeing young people grow up. And we have a saying, you may not be able to do anything about the family you come from, but you can do everything about the family you create.
So many street soldiers stay connected throughout their lives and have stayed connected throughout their lives?
Oh, well, I'll give you a great example. One of my young man, and he's probably listening right now, a young man named Andre Akins, who I found in East Oakland selling drugs and gangbanging at the age of 17, was highly infected when I when I met him. He came over to San Francisco. I would drive him home. Complete metamorphosis. I'll tell you what he's doing now. He's my second in command at the boys club. By the way, which works with both young men and young women. Let me get that straight. Yeah, it works with young men and young women. So yeah, not only is he connected, he's right behind
me.
He's
a general. I mean, use that soldier metaphor, right? He's up there in the high rank.
He's a colonel. I'm the general.
Colonel. You're the general. Okay, I thought maybe 5-star generals and 1-star generals or something like that.
But they come back. They mentor. They're there every week. You know, when we have the celebration this week, there'll be a whole bunch of them there saying thanks, Dr. Marshall, what you've done for me.
Talking to Joe Marshall, who has done extraordinary work in terms of providing academic and life skills support to over 1,300 boys and girls and violence prevention programs that have reached more than 15,000 students. I'm going to open up the phone lines. There are many of you who may want to talk about, well, what we're talking about, which is how to prevent violence and how to take kids out of lives that seem like they have dead ends, because they do have dead ends and ceilings that just they bang their heads against. You can feel free to join us. If you have questions or comments for Joe Marshall, please do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we'd like to hear from you. Again, toll-free, you can join us, 866-733-6786. Particularly like to hear from some of you for whom Dr. Joseph Marshall has made a difference. You can also email forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. There's also kind of a philosophy that you as a, like you said, your roots are as a teacher and a math teacher, I believe, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been a consistent message, almost philosophically, that you've tried to implant and imprint in the young people in your charge and the young people who have come under your influence, and that is respect the humanity of other people as opposed to respecting or having undue respect for the material or for what acquisitions can be. And that's been pretty consistent.
Well, a serious risk factor for them. Think of risk factors for heart disease. And so I use the exact same metaphor. A huge risk factor for violence is material values over people. I mean, for them, money is the most important. Material values are the most important. That's why you would sell drugs to a pregnant woman.
Well, that's why you'd hurt somebody or rob somebody. Yeah?
And I might say, I think that's a serious risk factor in society. I think, you know, the whole Wall Street debacle, the whole subprime mortgage issues, the whole Michael Milken, the whole Bernie Madoff thing is about material values over people. So I don't say, I think they've just sort of absorbed this whole materialism is the most important thing that the larger society feels. So, you know, we teach them that the most important thing are human beings and not money. And to put this very bluntly, I also have what I call commandments of violence, the way young people think who are really into violence. And one of their commandments is, and I'll put this in the, just like Moses' commandment, thou shalt get thy money on, which is the most important thing at that moment. But that's what's leading them down this path toward jail, to death. And so, yeah, they give up that risk factor, money over people.
Also, the whole sense of having a gun and possessing a gun, and not only for survival skills, but in many respects, as we were saying earlier, to feel bigger, to feel more powerful, to feel like you have control over your life when, in many instances, life is controlling you. That gets into the whole question of taking those guns away or making them believe that they don't need those guns, or what exactly?
Well, and we can hold getting to the whole issue of gun control if we want to.
Yeah,
but most of,
I don't know if you need to do that.
But the point is,
the philosophy.
It's simple. It's a risk factor. It's a risk. You carry a gun, there's a good chance something's going to happen.
But the kid will say to you, if I don't carry a gun,
they act differently, yeah. They think differently when they have one. It's a huge risk factor. And all I do is list, really. All I do is list the risk factors, you know, when it comes to violence. So I have to show them, it increases the risk, not decreases the risk.
But when they come back and counterpoint and say, I'm increasing the risk to me if I don't have a gun to protect myself, you say what?
All I show them is very simple. We have talks about that. I'll show them how many times, somebody, how they acted when they had the gun and how they didn't when they don't have the gun.
Comes down to mathematics again?
Well, they know, not so much math. They know it's a risk factor. They know how they think when they have a gun. And I tell them, look, there was a time when people used to fight. Right. And they didn't carry a gun. That's what I asked. How many times, were people, how come nobody died when you were a kid? Because we didn't shoot anybody. All right. And they know all their dead friends happen because they have a gun. They know how I think. They know it definitely increases the risk for them of being a victim or a perpetrator of violence if they have a gun. So they begin to think it's a risk factor. I don't need one. I can deal with it another way because I'm interested in staying alive and free and keeping other people alive and free. So they just don't carry one,
and
honestly.
The disease that you're talking about, guns being a symptom, guns being something that, creates even exacerbates the disease. You're talking also about, I believe here, the whole sense that with violent prevention, we've got kids who need purpose in life, don't they? I mean, above all, they need to have something that drives them, that they need to have some kind of goals, really. And it's not just playing basketball at night and that sort of thing.
No, the kids are all great. The kids are wonderful. They come in fine. They come in the world fine. But because of the problematic situations they live in, they believe that they have to do these things to survive. They get bad advice. They get bad information. They get bad instruction. They get bad example, but it looks good. It's as if they learn 2 + 2 = 5. And nobody's there to correct them and say 2 + 2 is really 4. In many cases, I'm just correcting the bad information they got in the first place that has led them off to a path from which, and I'm going to tell you, and it takes a toll on them, Michael. It takes a toll. These kids are angry. They're hurt. They're in pain.
Constant stress
really
in their
see.
Lives, too. Yeah.
Constant. I mean, you'd be surprised how many of these young people out there who they think have everything, going on, the drugs, the girls, all that, actually try and commit suicide. I mean, their lives are a mess. Hurting people hurt people. A big part of what I do is help them with all. They got, like I say, they get sold a bill of goods. And I'm here to say, hey, look at the toll it's taking on you. Look at the toll it's taking on your families. I'm here to help you out. Are they skeptical? Absolutely, because they've been used by every person they've ever met. From the beginning, here I come along saying, I want to help you. And so, yeah, it's a battle. It's definitely a battle. Believe me.
It's also a battle about misogyny, because that's sort of embedded in a lot of this way of life that we're talking about. And they're sold a bill of goods on that, too.
Huge risk factor. I keep coming back to those. They're all lined up. And I call it a negative view of women. Big time. Oh, yeah, sure. It's all part of it. The negative view of women, where they see women, the way women see themselves, is is a huge risk factor when it comes to violence. And that's even bigger than the kids I work with. You go around the world. You know, there are places where women are just seen in a negative light. You know, they can't go to school. They can't do so many things. That's a huge risk factor for violence. Absolutely.
Let's bring some of our callers into this. And we go, Emmanuel, who's joining us from Pittsburgh, California. Good morning. Emmanuel? No? Actually, he had a question about KMEL Street Soldiers, which you host. you want to talk about what kind of effect has that had?
Oh, the show is huge. I am always amazed, not by the vastness of the audience we have. And I can always tell depending on the topic or the guests that we have. The Street Soldiers has been on the air. I've been on the air almost 20 years, so not to talk about a show, but because of the station that we're on, we reach a lot of young people.
Yeah, on Sunday nights still.
Absolutely, yeah. Sunday nights, 8 to 10.
Let's get another caller on, and that's Molly. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, thank you so much. I'm a health educator from Alameda, and I just really appreciate all the work that you've done. I've, you know, heard of Street Soldiers since being a youth myself. On to my question, I actually changed it a little bit. I would like you to speak a little bit about vicarious trauma as a provider and what you do to take care of yourself. I mean, being in this work for 25 years, you know, we listen to a lot of youth stories, so I want to hear what you do to kind of come out of that and make sure that you have supports around you.
Well, that's a very important question. I told Joe when he came in, he hasn't lost his sweetness and his good temperament, but sometimes you must find this trying work and very challenging to your old being.
Well, I know what I'm up against. I know what I'm up against. I know I'm dealing with a lot of wounded young people. You know, they live in areas that are high crime areas a lot of times. The families, the relationships in the family are stressful. They're hurting. So, you know, a lot of what I do is help them with that trauma. I guess in a lot of cases, you know, we're doing therapy. But that's a bad word to young people. They see us as adults who are willing to help them out. So we can sit and have conversations and guide them. I think the key thing in there is no judgment. If young people feel like they're being judged, that's probably the worst thing you can do. So the meetings we have with young people are much like, you remember how Bill Cosby used to sit around with his kids and talk about issues that they face? They feel exactly like that, and, you know, that's what we do. Therapists will come in and say, you're doing therapy. I said, but they don't know that.
You mentioned Cosby. Remember that whole controversy over some of his remarks about, you know, the way kids wear their pants and, you know, coming down on that kind of stuff? Did you find that resonated with you, or did you
Sure. I mean, again, using in my medical model, pants sagging is a symptom. It really is. It's a symptom. Is a major symptom? No. But, you know, in my model, the way we look at things, pants sagging, kids running together in gangs, traveling in packs, we call it. We call it set tripping, claiming a neighborhood, claiming a, you know, Norteños, Serranos, claiming a particular. Those are all symptoms. They're minor symptoms. The major symptom is the way a young person thinks. So I get where Cosby, you know, as I say, Cosby's BC. He gets the way it used to be, and he wants that to come back.
Talking again with Joseph Marshall, and he is executive director and co-founder of the Omega Boys Club, Street Soldiers, and vice president of the San Francisco Police Commission. And we'll hear from more of you when we return, and we invite you to join the program again. You can do so by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have for Joe Marshall on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. More when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As part of our First Person series, we have Joseph Marshall with us, PhD and executive director and co-founder of the Omega Boys Club, Street Soldiers, and vice president of the San Francisco Police Commission, here with us in studio. And Omega's 25th anniversary celebration is this Thursday, October 25th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. You can visit street-soldiers.org for more information or call 1-800-SOLDIER, and that translates to 765 3437. We mentioned earlier that Omega Boys Club has provided, and by the way, it's not just a boys club. They've helped a lot of young women as well.
Yes.
Has provided academic and life skills support to over 1,300 boys and girls, and violence prevention programs have reached over 15,000 students. And a listener says, how do we measure success? And he says, when we hear about the number of people served by the program, it doesn't tell us about whether or not that interaction was successful. And also, it seems to me that the kids who need these sorts of programs the most are the least likely willing to participate in them. How do you reach those who don't want to be reached, and what are the accurate measures of success?
Great question. Great question. And the goal is really to help young people stay alive and free. That's what we do. That's what we do. So how do we know? We know by the young people that actually come to the program and end up staying alive and free. We know that. We see them. We see them years later. They are alive. They are free. We do follow up with those young people as many as we can, you know, keep our hands on and follow where they are. The other way we know is we go into schools and we work with young people. We do a lot of surveys. We've done a lot of rigorous evaluation around this. The young people have told us that this information helps them stay alive, helps them stay free, helps them stay out of violence. I've been invited literally, you know, by the United States government, by the United States Embassy, to take this whole model of the alive and free prescription violence as a disease to Nigeria, to Canada, to Haiti, to South Africa. The government of Thailand actually invited me over there to work with the young people over there. So we do have the formal, rigorous evaluations. I've met people who have said, you know, you've kept me, I've just listened to you on the radio, you know, for 4 years, and you kept me out of trouble all through high school. So that's how we know it actually works. I think there's a belief in many ways that that these young people, he asked me what my greatest challenge is, you know, what's the difference? I think people don't believe that, you know, young people really can be saved. That this, you know, something like this really works. I think there's an assumption that nothing can be done. And to this day, I think exists. I think there's really a value piece here. I think that people do not believe that these young people are value. There's value placed on these young folks. So my greatest challenge isn't really with the kids. I reach them in a variety of ways. They get dragged in by their parents. They listen to me on a radio show. You know, we know that this whole thing is working, believe me.
Well, when you mention the parents, in fact, I'm looking at a listener named Eugene who says, glad you're out there in the trenches. Great work you do. Very glad that you and your program are getting exposure. How do you address parents who may be misinformed themselves and pass that on to their kids? And also, how does one donate to your program? I'm sure that that question may not displease you. But let me get back to a previous one, though, and that is, do a lot of the kids that need help the most simply not come?
You know, there are three types of young people. The first is a young person who is into destructive behavior and needs to change, right? Obviously. We get a lot of those young people, and I reach them in a variety of ways. The second group, which I think is the greater group that I work with, are young people who are good kids, listen to their parents, listen to their teachers, but they beginning to feel there's something wrong with being good. Most of the kids I work with are fine, and they're trying to start to – I want to make sure they don't – I don't have to fix something that's not broken. Those are the kids that become the first group. So we also go into juvenile halls working with kids. I go into Alameda County Juvenile Hall. We go into San Francisco Juvenile Hall. I don't know how – yes, there probably are a lot of young people that really need this that we don't reach. But that's because – which is why I've taken to teaching and training other adults who can reach them. You know, I'm like a doctor. I have my own medical school. So I train somebody in Seattle, Washington. I train somebody in Los Angeles, California. I train somebody in Sacramento, California.
How long do they train with you usually?
Oh, I can teach them the prescription. We have a training institute. It's a three-day training. They learn a prescription, they then go back, and they begin to work with young people in their area. I cannot reach everybody, obviously, because I'm finite. But what I can do is create other people who understand the alive and free prescription, understand that violence is a disease, and do the same thing with people literally all over the world. And that's probably really what I spend most of my time doing.
Well, when a kid says to you, though, why should I be good? What do you say?
Why
should I be good? I mean, you're trying to teach them how to be good, really, in many respects. You just alluded to that. And if a kid comes back and says, why should I be good?
I ask them, do they want to stay alive and free?
It's that simple.
Yeah. What does your doctor ask you when you go into the doctor's office? They ask you, do you want to stay?
Yeah, but you know, people go into the doctor's office and they say, well, listen, you know, if I'm going to die young, I'd rather die drinking booze and doing things that are unhealthy.
Yeah, but they really want to stay alive. I know they really want to stay alive and free. I'm used to everything they say. I know what they really want. And let me tell you what they're used to, Michael. They're used to somebody saying, okay, I understand. No. You know, what they want me to
they want to be challenged.
There are so many people who have walked away from them. They're actually shocked when I say, I know what you really want.
But they also want to be challenged by you.
Absolutely.
I had a listener who said, what do you do to help inform parents? And he also wanted to know how to donate to your program. So let's get those on.
Oh, please donate. Give us a call, 1-800-765-3437. Or you can go to the website, street-soldiers.org. We appreciate it. Believe me. Thank you very much.
And talk about your work with parents, because sometimes they're the source of the problem. They don't provide the values, or they don't provide the home life, or they don't even care about their children.
I actually do not work with parents. I work with a young person. I make sure I can't fix that. I mean, a lot of parents actually come. I give parents the same information that, you know, we give to young people. But I teach the young people. I help young people so they don't exacerbate their situation when they go home. Just like I can't fix the neighborhood, I can't fix the parents. I do help them create a family that they don't have at home. And parents trust me so much, they'll say, whatever Dr. Marshall says, you do. I'm behind you 100%.
Yeah, well, you've built up and earned that trust. 25 years. Joe Marshall here with us in studio this hour. We're going to go to more of your calls. Sarah, join us. Hi.
Hi. Mike, I just want to know, what as a young person, as a young woman who's not really, has never been around gang members or any kind of violence, what can we do in this to help Mr. Marshall as volunteer work to help him out and learn more about our society? You know, of course, I'm a white person in my 40s, and I've never been in bad neighborhoods, or I've done a lot of volunteer work, but I've never been around kids like that.
Are you ready to go into the Bayview, though, Sarah, and roll up your sleeves? Is that what you're saying? Do volunteer work in that?
Sarah, first of all, it doesn't matter if you're white. I use this from a medical perspective. So think, my doctor at Kaiser, and I do go to Kaiser, not you, Kaiser, does not look like me. She's not even a man. She's a young, she's an Asian female, but she is a great doctor. And it's because of the knowledge base that she has. What I can give to you is a knowledge base. So that you can help young people stay alive and free. It has nothing to do with being black or white or male or female. It's the information that I give to young people. So what I can help you with is that information. If you're interested in that, just call my office, you know, use the 1-800 number or go to the website, and I would love to provide you with this information that a lot of young people and a lot of adults just don't have.
And thank you, Sarah, for your call and your intentions, and we'll get another caller on here. Eva, good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks so much, Michael. I'm rather shocked that in nearly 40 minutes there's been absolutely, as far as I can tell, no discussion of the ill effects, in fact, the disastrous effects of the 30-year war on drugs on these neighborhoods. And your guest, despite his PhD, appears to be missing the elephant in the room, which is the absolute disaster that the drug war has been. And I just finished reading Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, which details a lot of this, and it seems, and I'm also aware that both George P. Schultz on the right and Paul Volcker have signed off on the Global Commission on Drug Policy report, which, you know, describes the drug war as a 30-year disaster that's ruined black neighborhoods. We have more African Americans in prison right now than were enslaved in 1850.
Well, let me get Joe Marshall a comment on the drug war. Do you see it as invidious?
Well, I gotta say this. That's a given. I know about intentionality. I mean, it's been a war on black people from the time we got here, the war on communities of color. That is something I start there. I start there. And so I have to teach my young people to be able to navigate through all of that. My young people do not get caught up in drugs. It's as if a trap has been set for them, and my job is to make sure that they don't fall into the trap. Certainly, there's a failed war on, war on black people, war on drugs. It hasn't worked. It's not going to work. The kids are the eight ball here. They're the eight ball here. I have to teach them that things are a trap. Do not get involved. Do not get caught up in that. And I'm able to guide them around all of those traps. Certainly, there are policymakers that can deal with that. I work with the young people and show them how not to get caught up in that trap that's set up for them. It definitely is that. There's no doubt about it.
You've also got some challenges, I think, dovetailing off of Eva's call, with respect to the police in the neighborhoods and establishing a sort of relations with them where they're treating young people often like criminals when they're not.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I'm on the police commission. I'm on the police commission. I have enough. Yeah, look, the young people I work with have enough issues to deal with. I got to make sure the police don't make it worse.
I had Paul Chignell in here recently, you know, who is in charge, Captain Chignell, in charge of the Bayview. Seems like there's genuine, I've known Paul for many years, but there's genuine attempts and sincere attempts to really build.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There is. You know, Chief Sir is great. Chief Sir is great. My young people have to navigate a world of often officers who commit misconduct, and they got to navigate a world of peers who can misconduct. They have a tough road to hoe. That's why I'm there to guide through them all and make sure they're part of the solution and not part of the problem. I always say one person can do a lot of damage and one person can do a lot of good. But the fact that it's out there, here, let me say this. We have always been pushing uphill, always, from day one. The issue is, have we been up for the challenge? I got to make sure my young people are up for the challenge of fighting a system that's often really against them from day one.
What do you attribute? I mean, this is a first-person series. I want to get a little bit behind Joe Marshall's consciousness here. You've been passionate, committed to this now for a quarter of a century. You've been doing this kind of work. And clearly, you were interested in young people because you decided to go on a career as a teacher initially, as we've said. But where does that passion come from? I mean, is it faith in your upbringing? Is it just a sense of wanting to do good? What is it?
I think I've always been altruistic from the day one. My dad used to always tease me about that.
Call having a good heart, maybe?
I'm the oldest of nine kids, you know. So I've been taking care of kids for a long time, taking care of my brothers and sisters. I think a turning point came for me when I got to college and I read the autobiography of Malcolm X at the age of 19. I was a junior at USF. I read that book. It had a huge impact upon me. Community then became my passion. You remember, I'm old enough, I was raised in a time, when community was number one. The 60s, the 70s was a big time. I was just part of that. And the kids always tell me, you're different. Dr. Marshall, you're different. I said, well, in my time, I was ordinary, you know. So, Pummy asked me the other day, who are the main influences in your life? I say the three M's, Malcolm,
Martin Luther
Medgar
King,
and, you know, and Martin Luther King and Medgar Evers, you know. Yeah. That has been my passion. I went into teaching, and, you know, you're right. It's definitely been my life. But I think that book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, had a huge impact on me and directed my life in this direction.
Haven't been sort of steered in a different, now that a lot of stuff has come out from the new biography of Malcolm X, from
Manning Marable's book. I actually haven't read that.
Some of it's a bit disillusioning.
Right. Yeah, I haven't read that.
You get the real Malcolm X, at least.
I've heard about
it,
though.
Not the Alex Haley Malcolm X. Aditya, right, speaking of the failure of the opportunity and good intention model, what would be some of the more practical advice that you can give us to help with changing the internal wiring of these students?
Oh, you got to know what the wiring is. For me, it was really a big deal. I remember one day I was talking to young people, and I would just ask them just some questions. And they asked me if they know the Ten Commandments, literally, Moses' Ten Commandments. And nobody knew more than three or four. And as I went to sit down, they said, but we have our own commandments. We have our own commandments. They have their own beliefs. And I was, you know, any good teacher is also a good student. So I began to, and when they told me the way they believe, I would look at them, I said, no wonder you're in jail. I said, I'm not better than you. I just don't think like you. They really have a certain way of thinking. And
were those commandments, though? I mean, can you give us an example?
I don't want to take too much, but think of a young person in the back of a car who is, you know, somebody in the neighborhood has gotten killed and he's having second thoughts. And here's his first second thought. I don't want to go to jail. I really don't. My uncle told me about prison, 25 years of life. I do not want to go. That thinking never has a chance to stop him. That thought, that second thought. Here's the next second thought. I'm my mother's last son. If she loses me, it'll break her heart. She's already lost two sons. I love my mother. Love of mother never has a chance. It's because he has been programmed early on with a way of thinking, just like a computer, with this commandment. I'm going to say it just like the kids told me. Thou shalt be down.
We just no profanity here.
No. Okay. Thou shalt be down for thy set, thy hood, or thy crew, which basically believes his allegiance to is to his neighborhood. And that overrides, I'm using the word override, fear of prison and love of mother. It's not that he wants to go to jail. It's not that he doesn't love his mother. He's been programmed that way. And unless he's deprogrammed, but Michael, think of this. You can program or get somebody to believe that they should get in a plane, fly across the world, fly into some buildings in New York, blow up everybody, and kill themselves. That's a real program, which is why America's got a problem. You can have all the peace talks you want. Unless those folks are deprogrammed with the way they think, you're going to always have a problem. A big issue for me is getting that the young people don't want to die. They have to give up the program. A lot of my time with young people is deprogramming this. Here's another one. I didn't know young people went to jail for other people.
It's a code.
I call it a commandment because if I say attention and your sergeant says attention, you don't think, let me reflect on the command given to me by my officer. Your body responds automatically. These young people are on automatic. So unless I go in there and deprogram them, take away those commandments, they're going to continue to act the way they act. I know what those commandments are. The public doesn't.
Well,
they just think the kids are crazy.
The commandments include never snitch.
And that's yet, a big part of the commandment.
In so many instances, you know, how can you deprogram that? It's almost in the blood, isn't it?
It is definitely part of their thinking. I'm an educator. I know how to teach. I know how to go in and show how they got programmed that way in the first place and how it is not getting them what they want. And what is the question I always come back to? Do you want to stay alive and free? And I say, if you want to do that, then you got to let this go. I know people don't believe it. I do it all the time.
I know you do it all the time.
And yet,
sometimes it just seems so challenging because there's a phrase that comes to my mind. It's actually a poet's
phrase. If you think of a disease, it is challenging. If you think of fighting AIDS in Africa, it is challenging. It's not that it's not challenging. It's that people take a belief that there is a cure, that something must be done. I'm the same way. I'm the doctor of the disease of violence.
But I keep thinking, for some reason, I'll tell you what's coming into my head. There's a William Blake, famous British poet, talked about mind-forged manacles. That's what we're talking about, mind-forged manacles. You got to really take those manacles and unbind them. That's more than doctors can do. That's kind of like strongman work, isn't it?
But they want to live. All they need to see is how – see, they really think that this is something that's going to work. Here I am saying, again, I use a simple metaphor. You've learned that 2 + 2 = 5, all right? I'm here to tell you 2 + 2 = 4. Is this working for you? Well, no. Okay. Well, if it's not working, why isn't it working? Because you got the wrong information in the first place. And then we begin the process. It is wonderful.
We go to calls and we go to Berkeley. Jennifer, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Dr. Marshall. I'm really inspired by your work. I direct a program at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business called Young Entrepreneurs at Haas. And similar to your work, we teach life skills and academic skills using entrepreneurship. I have been really inspired by Greg Boyle's work in East Los Angeles, and I just got a press release this morning. I live in Oakland, and talks about Oakland ceasefire, and I was really curious, have you been involved in Oakland ceasefire and what your thoughts are about it? The press release talks about how that more than 60% of all homicides this year are concentrated in East Oakland, and it's a very small population of people, less than 1% of the population. So it's going to be really targeted at that community. And kind of linking back to what you were talking about earlier and also Greg Boyle's work, that the students at this age, I call them students, are the most important thing in their life is their peer group, and that's developmentally appropriate. And Greg Boyle's work focused on understanding that that the peer group was so important, and that they were not criminals because they cared about their family, which is their other peers. So just what are your thoughts on Oakland ceasefire, and also that this is developmentally normal for kids this age?
Well, I do know a little bit about ceasefire. I know something about Father Boyle's work. And first, before I say it, any program that can help stop the violence, I'm in favor of. Let me just say, ceasefire works with a very narrow group of people. What it targets, those, I guess, the greatest risk to commit violence, And you know, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I really do. I really don't know how successful the programs are. I know they do ceasefire all over the United States, in Boston, in Chicago. My concern always with ceasefire is, do they really create change? Suppose you stop somebody from doing something. You're out there and you absolutely stop an incident from happening. It just may be an incident waiting to happen. The key then, for me, what's more important is to get the person who was about to perpetrate violence is to actually change so that that person doesn't do it. I mean, if you put a cop on every street, right, they're not going to do it. But the problem is that person is just, when the cop leaves, they're going to do it. So I don't know that ceasefire actually does that. The other thing I'm concerned about it, and I'm just saying this because I'm critiquing, is that what about all those young people waiting to become that way? If it's just targeting this narrow group, which, again, I'm not saying it shouldn't do, there are tons of young people waiting to become infected. So I don't think there's nearly enough prevention in that particular model. That's just my thoughts. What I do is really change behavior and prevent people from getting infected in the first place. So what I've done with folks with ceasefire is actually train them in the methodology that I use. Just have them come through this training, and I've done this in a lot of places, that they are better equipped to do the work and get the results that they say they want.
Well, when you talk about this medical model of yours, it brings to mind the fact that sometimes these kids are quarantined. What do I mean by that? I mean, I'm curious to get your responses. Years ago, I did a program with a leader of the Crips and leader of the Bloods, and they just had a sit-down, and they came to a temporary truce.
Right.
And I thought to myself, they probably were completely quarantined from each other. They didn't even have any kind of human contact or interaction, because you don't go into my hood, I don't go into your hood. If you do, you know, you risk your life and all that sort of thing. And you take that and you expand it on the level of, you know, Israelis and Palestinians talking to each other,
right,
or Pakistanis and Indians.
Right.
They don't even, how can they relate
the
to the humanity
stuff,
because they don't talk to them? They
it's
don't
the
see
exact
them.
Same stuff. And, you know, there are a lot of programs that work with only Crips, or work with only Bloods, or only work with one turf or one territory. I work with anybody. You can all work, because I'm going to tell you, if I don't do that, then I'm legitimate. I'm saying, yes, you are actually enemies. Mm-hmm. I'm saying you're not enemies. So from day one, and we were born in great, you know, gang violence and turf in the city of San Francisco. Everybody was allowed to come and be there, because I didn't want to operate in silos. If I want to break down gangs or break down turf, then I can't work with them separately, because I'm saying, yes, you are actually enemies. I'm saying you're not enemies. Let's come in the room. You're all going to learn the same information. They then become models of what they should be, because a lot of these kids grew up and they were friends in the first place.
Joe Marshall, our guest this hour, and our next caller is Randolph. Good morning. You're on.
Hi. How are you? Thanks, Dr. Marshall, and thanks, Michael. I am an African-American male in my mid-40s now, living in Oakland, and I am absolutely troubled by the number of black men in jail. But I'm hoping that you can just talk about law enforcement and the black community's challenge in getting folks off of the streets, because I think it's just apparent that there's exponentially more people out there doing the killing than those who are open to change or help. And at some point, it seems that we just have to get some of the folks off the street. And, you know, like the no snitching commandment and that sort of thing is working counter to. And we know in many instances who's doing the work, even if doing the killing, even if the police do not. And it seems like we just have to get some of these folks off the street. So just wanted to see if you could comment on the law enforcement and the black community's role and responsibility and self-accountability in helping you do the things that you're doing.
I've never said that young people who are doing wrong should not go to jail. They should. My concern is that when they're there, they get treated for what ails them. So I don't have a problem with that. And as far as, you know, the no snitch thing, everybody knows where I stand. If you do something wrong to hurt the community, I'm telling. Everybody knows that. I do not believe in that. Now, having said that, nobody ever does anything around me because they know what I'm going to tell. So the no snitch thing is the worst thing you can do because it allows those who are perpetrating the violence to continue to do that unimpeded. And so, I don't believe that at all. I think that's got to go. I say it's a commandment of violence. It contributes to violence unless the community stands up and says, he did it, she did it, they got to go, and aids law enforcement in getting that person off. I agree with that completely. At the same time, there's got to be programs. There's got to be what I call this alive and free prescription put in place, you know, to help those young people who do get infected and believe that's the young way. You got to do both. You got to do it all. I see it like a doctor. I see it like treating a disease. You got to prevent. You got to intervene. You got to rehabilitate on all levels.
And I thank the caller. Boy, Dr. Joe Marshall, that doctor title carries all kinds of meaning with it, doesn't it? I want to remind listeners, Omega's 25th anniversary celebration is this Thursday, October 25th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. Visit street-soldiers.org for more information or call 1-800-SOLDIER. That's 765-3437. And here's Anita who tweets, hearing Joe Marshall speak on youth is inspiring. How can young professionals in the Bay Area help Omega Boys Club?
Give us a call, 1-800-765-3437. Go to the website, street-soldiers.org. There are many ways. I adopt schools. I work with schools. I train individuals. In this whole alive and free prescription, there are seminars. There's all kinds of ways to be able to help. Just give us a call. I can direct you in ways that you can help us save and keep young people alive and free. Thank you.
Joe, thank you for all the work you have been doing, do, and continue to do. And may you continue to do it with the same kind of passion and force and efficacy that you have proven in these 25 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
Joseph Marshall, Executive Director and co-founder of Omega Boys Club, Street Soldiers, and Vice President of the San Francisco Police Commission. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to Dan Zoll, who is our senior editor, and to the staff that helps us day to day. I want to thank our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.